Okay, first broadcast message. We're supposed to have that speech in English. How many people really want it in English? Raise your hands. Okay, well, looks like a significant number, so. Okay, yeah, welcome to our speech on 90C3. This is going to be about attacking embedded systems, just to make sure you're sitting in the right place. This is not about your mobile phone. If you have to get rid of your SIM lock protection or whatever, there are surely people over here to help you, but this is more about networked embedded systems, as in Ethernet. FTR will run the first part of the show, and I will go into some more hex games, and, well, now I pass it on.
Thanks for that, FRX. Yeah, we separate the show into two basic parts. The first part actually is my part, as said. I want to show some basic design failures within embedded systems and what the main problems are. And in the second part, we want to show the real exploitation of an embedded system within two examples, as far as I know. Two nice examples, and both are very funny. And yeah, let's have some fun and see where the problems are and how we can have fun with embedded systems. Basically, first problem should be we want to define what an embedded system is. Embedded system is, from our point of view, nothing else than a very small device with a very handy Ethernet port used for any kind of functionality you need within the network. Might be a print server, might be a switch, might be something else. Whatever you want, whatever you need, it is a small device. Nothing else, nothing more. Just because it doesn't have a monitor, it doesn't mean it's not attackable. It's not interesting for us. The main design includes that normally these little devices run a monolithic operating system, which causes some problems within the access rights between the separate elements of the devices. Basically, there are normally none differences between the elements, and so far we can have some more fun later on with these little devices. Yeah, that's it. Having some major design failures. What is the default problem within the design? Normally, all these little devices are created for one special purpose and for one special function, and nobody gives a thought of it if it could be used for something else than exactly this functionality it's provided for. And so developers leave their vectors within the source code, and within the development phase, whatever they have, they leave it in because they don't think about any further use of these vectors from other people like we are. In addition to this, lots of these little devices bring with their little out-to-do-something features. What does it mean? We have a little small device which comes out of the box. You plug it in, you put your Ethernet wire into the machine, and start the engine, and the first thing it does, I need an IP address, can I have one? And ask for DHCP stuff, something like that. Running some small outer protocols using for communication between devices of the same kind, and all these little things are normally enabled, and you have to disable them actively, and normal user doesn't even care about it and just run it as it is, as it comes out of the box. The next problem is that standards given from within RFC form or something like that are used and adapted and normally extended by some special features we need for our little device because we are very funny and we are crazy developers, and we use the standard and ignore some basic elements, and we don't even think about the consequences of these violation of the original standards. The next thing is normally caused by the marketing people. Yeah, we need some more functionality here, we need some more stuff over there, and we need something new in there. Developers, please get this running, up and running, and we need this in within 2 months, 1 month or less. And then it's problematic for the developers to properly design the new functionalities and the new sub-functionalities within these devices. And so security often is then left out of scope, out of development, and so the fun parts later, the fun part for us comes later if we see these devices with these new functionalities where security wasn't any longer in mind of development. Let's come to the first example. We have seen the Lucent Brick. The Lucent Brick is layer 2 firewall running an Inferno OS operating system. The Lucent Brick is certified by the NSA as very secure, very stable, very very wealthy little device. But it has some little problems where we would say this is something you would never expect from a certified device. The first problem is that ARP requests are forwarded over the device regardless of what the firewall rules are. What does it mean for us? You just sit there on the device reading all the ARP requests coming in and you see who is out there in the network, and you can easily identify other devices than your own by knowing nothing of them, just getting the ARP request and see what's coming in. Even if the firewall rules say no traffic forwarded from segment A into segment B. But the ARP requests you will see in here, which are sent from these machines within the subnet, within the subnet. And this is something that shouldn't happen on a firewall, from my point of view. The next very funny thing is ARP reply poisoning is very handy and very useful on this device. Over here we have the management server, which is used for configuration, logging, monitoring the little device. Naturally, also this machine has an own IP address with an own MAC address. And as it is, if the machine, if the little device, the firewall, wants to speak to the management server, it needs to resolve the IP address to corresponding MAC address. And therefore, we need to have this information within the ARP cache. But once this machine is sending out an ARP request for this IP address, you might just reply with a new IP address, with your MAC address to the system, with the IP address of the management server, and the result is the management server is not longer available for this little firewall. I mean, this is quite funny because there all the logging is going on, and everything you need is going on over there, and if this machine is no longer available, what's the use of this? The next little problem within the SN routers itself, mostly all the SN routers except the MAX-TNT have a little undocumented protocol based on UDP. This is used to the discard port. And as already said, this is a misuse of a standard. The discard port should normally take the packet and just discard it. That's why it's called discard port. But the developers of the little SN routers thought, okay, cool, we use that port for another purpose. There we hand on our UDP protocol. And if you talk to the machine and get a response of the UDP packets, you can read out lots of very, very interesting information outside of the router, such as IP addresses and MAC and netmasks, MAC addresses, name, serial number, and all the stuff. Even from the internal side, where you're having no direct access to, you can just look through the machine into the internal subnets and know what are the configured networks on the back end side of the machine. And I mean, if I'm running a router as a gateway to the outer world and having my own network inside, I don't want to have anybody looking from outside on my machine and getting information what my internal IP addresses are. Sorry, this is something I don't like. Normally not. In addition to this, you can use SNMP to write, to set the backend, the internal IP addresses of the machine remotely. And if I'm running a router, I don't want to have my IP addresses changed on the machine from outside. Sorry, guys, this is not the purpose of a router.
Interesting point to note here. this setting IP address thing actually works even if SNMP is disabled. So you use the UDP. You use that UDP protocol to the discard port with the SNMP write community. Sure, if you disable SNMP, you don't change the community, and you change the IP address of the primary interface of the router, which is kind of interesting for major dial-in installations such as T-Online.
Oh, this is anyway your slides.
Sorry, introduce that one. This is kind of like 10-day O-day stuff. And I thought it mixes in quite nicely with the design failures. Some of you might know that we have a certain affection to Cisco systems. Here's one of their design failures. You have a routing protocol, enhanced IGRP, which relies on the fact that every router tells everyone else, hey, I'm here and I want to participate in routing stuff. And I asked myself the question, well, what if you have like a population problem, as in you get tons of new routers want to participate on it? This is surely a design failure. What happens here is you sit on a network and you tell the router, there's a new neighbor. There's a new neighbor. There's a new neighbor. And you, of course, do that in a program, so you produce about 10,000 neighbors per second. Well, the router thinks, well, okay, there's a new neighbor, and I really have to tell him about the routing engine and what I'm using, routing table, stuff like that. So I want to talk to him. I need his MAC address. Okay, I opt for it. Now, usually you would say, okay, he opts for the router does not exist, the opt time's out. Unfortunately, the process that runs enhanced IGRP is the one that kicks off sending packets. So every time the process enhanced IGRP figures, oops, I still have to talk to the guy, he kicks off an op request. Now, this happens once a second until the dead timer in this protocol times out. Now, this dead timer, in turn, is in 16-bit value, so you have about 18 hours. Okay, so what you do is you send some neighbor announcements to a Cisco router, and then you watch the Cisco router using all available CPU and interface power to ARP on the network, which means your network is not going to do anything else. Funny about it, you can do it remotely for 11 series iOS because you can send the enhanced IGRP announcements, which are usually multicast, as unicast across the internet. And depending on the configuration of the router, it will kill its internal network. Now, okay, here is the fix information from Cisco Systems. they just decided to, well, offer you additional hardware. There's not going to be a Cisco iOS fix for that. Back to FTR.
Okay, we have spoken about routers, and we have spoken about little firewalls. Now, let's speak about printers. I mean, printers are supposed to print something, but we will speak about this idea later. What is the idea of HP printers? HP printers are very handy and very, very good machines, and if you run at least the second version of the driver, everything would be fine. But, I mean, the big boxes in your office have normally several ways to access them, and this is quite handy for you if you want to administer these machines. You have a web server running, which allows you to change configuration. You have SNMP, you have PGL, we speak about this later. And all these different access methods have different ideas of how to protect themselves for unauthorized access. So you have with the HTTP port and the tunnel port, you have the same password to use, it's the admin password. For the SNMP stuff, you have the normal stuff like SNMP write, SNMP read communities. PGL has an own security password. And if you see the picture and you get an idea of what's going on there, and if you see something like this, that the admin password used for tenant and HTTP is available via SNMP read over this SNMP variable, I mean, then you come closely to the point that there are lots of people thinking about security within HTTP, but unfortunately, they don't know each other. The one guy over there is thinking of, okay, I'm making HTTP secure. The other guys for SNMP thinking, okay, it might be necessary to have this within the SNMP tree, but that this is a security violation for this element is not known to HTTP. And so far, I would say they should think about their own internal procedures, how to build machines and how to create their own software. How to talk, yeah. Okay, next step, PGL. For us, very interesting was PGL. PGL is a printer job language, normally used for configuration issues within your job, your printing job. You can say how many pages you want to print. You can access the panel, can set stuff to the panel, the printer panel, and all those little things. But luckily, this one is protected by very, very, very complicated password, a number of 1 to 65,535, which basically needs you 6 hours to brute force, and then you are into the PGL and can freely talk to the printer via PGL. Okay, I mean, I can now change some stuff in the job and some stuff on the print jobs, but PGL allows you to do more stuff on the machine. First of all, you can see the spool directories within the printer, which contain the jobs. This is quite nice. You can see the jobs running through the printer. The next thing is some PCI markers with some nice information, like header information for your letters, for your company. You can do it as PCI markers. And the most interesting part from our point of view, the first most impressive part, that's the second one, also very cool, is that the neural models have a file system. Normal file system, as you know, from your machine, from your laptop. Within the file system, everything is stored. Everything the printer needs is stored within the file system. First of all, the firmware, the web server content, some configuration elements from subsystems, and you can freely access the file system by downloading and uploading files via PGL. And this brought us to the idea, use the machine as your file server. I mean, if you got something very handy, very tricky, and you don't want that anybody pursue you and find this document on your machine, on your laptop, you just put it on the printer and store it there, because nobody will ever look on a printer. You need a handy. We've coded a little command line tool, and this shows you the file system, and somehow you have the device, the volume number, then you have normal file directories and file names, and normal stuff as you know from your machine. Freely copy and yeah, your stuff on the printer and get it down, get it up.
Everyone in the room who knows a forensics expert who would look at the printer to find the exploit, please raise your hand. That's what I thought.
That's what we saw too here. In addition to this, we have written a little tool for the real hackers, for the real Windows hackers. We created a Windows GUI where you can change the environment variables of the machine, where you can have full access to the file system, downloading, uploading your files as described. You can also change the display message of the printer. I mean, have you ever seen running people around in an office when a printer says, please insert coin? People get crazy on this. Or the other one, also very cool, is what I have to say in German, is Tona klumpig. Okay, let's have a little look on this little tool. This is the front end, quite easy. Just type in your IP address, the port number the printer listens on, connect to the machine, and the next thing is right over here. We have the file system area. On this side, we have the local side, your local side, where you can change your directories as normal. It's not as quite as handy as the Explorer, but it's okay. And on the other side, you see the printer volume, where your file system is located, how many space you have, and all the file servers, and you can just exchange files between you and your printer. The next element is quite interesting is the environment variables, all the stuff you have over here. You can easily change them in here. And in addition to the stuff with this inside coin story, you can lock the panel totally. I mean, you just say, I'm offline, please press ready to go online and block the panels. And nobody can even press the button. I mean, the printer's blocked forever. Nobody will ever play again with it until they switch the power off.
Das wird gespeichert.
Depends on. As far as I see. Okay, the next thing. I mean, okay, now we have the printer used for files as file server. This is quite nice, but I mean, it's not even the best idea to play with the printer. I mean, there's more. I mean, printers have really good processors, having an operating system, having some power, and have a lot of idle time during the daytime. I mean, why don't use the printer for something else than for printing? Yes, the other point. That's a good point, and they are not always connected yet, and normally not turned off during the nighttime. Why? That's where ChiVM comes into play. What is ChiVM? ChiVM is part of the new printers from HP. It's used for... It's part of the web browser elements, and it's running in... It's actually Java virtual machine. With this virtual machine, you can do whatever you want. We will come to it later. The big machines normally have a default installed. And in addition to that this is used on printers, HP printed out this little statement. And this gives me a big thought. I mean, the very interesting part is over here. What does it mean to us? I mean, printer is the one thing, and we know for sure that other devices than printers will be used to run ChiVM, such as some switches we know about and some other elements.
Last things we heard about ChiVM in HP products and where HP sold it was for setup systems like your Premiere decoder or stuff. And... someone, this is not verified, but someone told us that Siemens tries to enter the network storage area market, and, they run on ChiVM.
We come to the use of this now, step by step. First, this little ChiVM has a standard loader to upload new services to ChiVM to extend the functionality. This is quite handy, quite cool, so you can play with the printer more stuff than normally printing. We know for sure that a German company develops some elements for some services which are used to collect documents, which has to be printed out every morning for the CEO, that he can see what's coming out of the company. So they actualize their internal communication. This bothers the lady, okay, they're writing service in that manner. Let's write another service and upload this to the printer. Unfortunately, this little default loader requires that these little services you load up are signed JAR files. HP figured out that this is not even the best idea to do it, so we reduce the security and release an easy loader, which doesn't need any signings. So you can just upload your JAR files directly without any access restrictions. Just do it, call the loader, and everything is fine. The other possibility to bring your stuff onto the machine is just via the PGL file exchange we have shown already. And we change the content of the csconfig file, which is used to identify the different services. HP self was time, was quite a time, very, very, very nice and very, very... polite to provide you with information. Unfortunately, the whole ChiVM division is closed currently. You know more, about it. No?
Well, yeah, the story goes, since we did that speech first time at DEF CON in Vegas, at this time they had classes, documentation, and the Chi server still online. A month later, the web server disappeared, along with the whole developer network. A statement from HP is this was a business decision and had nothing to do with the security issues published. Second statement, they still use ChiVM. So Unfortunately, officially, there is no Java classes and stuff to work with. So if you want to play with the printer, you have to had downloaded it before, but fortunately they did a mistake before shutting down the site, releasing the server under the LGPL in open source. So if anyone finds that stuff interesting, let me know and I put the source of the Shai server on the FTP server.
Okay, now we know. Now we just repeat this, how to get the stuff onto the machine. There are two different ways to do so. The first way is using the easy loader, the default loader, exchanging default loader by the easy loader, and then using the easy loader to upload your new jar files to this. Just call the easy loader and upload your jar file to the machine. What this steps basically do nothing else than change the content of the CS config. And this is something you could do by yourself. Just use our tools we've provided, and change the CS config by yourself and upload the classes by your own hand, and everything is fine. You get the stuff up and running. Okay, now we talked how to get the stuff on the machine. Now we want to see what's possible and how to play with the stuff. The first thing is we have to say some notes about ChaiVM. ChaiVM is, as already seen, very, very, very stable. Yeah, it isn't stable. The biggest problem we had, even the development environment you can run on your own PC is not as stable as normal programming language is. And if you get your stuff running on your development environment and you put the stuff onto the machine, onto the printer, and you hope it's running now, it's not necessarily the point, because there's a big difference between your development environment and the printer itself. The behavior is quite different. And there's a very, very important note. I mean, everybody who wants to develop some elements with ChaiVM and wants to play and test it on your printer, you might need exactly this as an SNMP variable to reset the printer, because we needed it very, very often. Actually, this is what we can think about Chai. It's like close, normally. Okay, what have we done? We've created some little things on a printer. The first very interesting part is we implemented a port scanner on the printer, which runs on the printer and scans your network. I mean, I don't want to be the guy in front of the IDS system which says, your printer is scanning your network. I mean, we are talking currently over by printers, and as we've seen, switches and other stuff shall be used through ChaiVM later on. And if you sit on your IDS system and even your switches are scanning your network, I would be scared. The next thing we've created is a little cracker program just to see how the performance is. We brute forced crypt strings on the printer and include this into the web server, just to have another web page on your web server which says, give me your crypt password and I give you the clear text later. It's a printer.
You basically go to the printer, pass it your crypt string from whatever Unix box you got it, let it run and come back 2 days later and just check out what came out of it. And it's quite fast because it's in MIPS. So it has a MIPS processor, it has plenty of idle time, and the best thing is, even if it runs full power and tries to break your crypt string, it still prints. So nobody's going to even notice it.
I mean, and in addition to this, you don't also only need to run this via the open ports on the machine. You can even create your own ports and create your own protocols. Everything you can do in Java, you can do it on a printer. I mean, Java is quite powerful, by the fact that I don't like this thing, different story. But everything you can implement in Java, you can implement on a printer, under the limitations of ChaiVM, what stability and stuff like that means. This is the screenshot from the printer with the script string. Just bring it in and get your results later. This is actually taken from a printer. Okay. What's the problem with ChaiVM? First, all the ChaiVM services are trusted on each other. Whenever you get one ChaiVM service running, you can control the other. whatever they are used for and whatever they are supposed to do. Whenever you get control on the machine, you get your code, you have full control of everything else what's running on the printer. I mean, this is something I really want to have if I'm in a foreign network and if I want to control some machine on the network for my personal use. The next thing, there are also already some really cool Chai services out there, which could be very interesting. The first thing is the notifier services. Whenever something is going on in printer, this notifier services is allowed to send you an email. And it might also attach a document, which is printed. I mean, I don't need to break into the machine of the CEO or the other executive guys over there. I just take the printer and let the printer send me the documents when they come out of the machine. Because this is close to final, and these are the final contracts. I mean, why the hell shall I hack tons of machines when I just get the printer and get the documents for free? Via email out of your company network. The next thing is Chimail. Very important, very interesting thing. It's a little service which is supposed to work over firewalls. What does it basically mean and how does it work? Okay, the idea is this little service gets configured an email account where it pulls and looks for emails if something is coming in. You just set up the service, say, look at evil.gov somewhere, this is my account, and whenever you want to communicate to this printer and you are any longer within this network, you're just sitting at home, you send an email to your email account over there, the printer will pick it up, and luckily you can send commands, real commands which will be executed on the printer later on within these emails.
You can even make it send you back the results.
I mean, this is something really, really handy and really, really neat. Funny, because you're just sitting at home and don't have any control anymore about your remote network. You aren't any longer on stage. You just send the stuff into the printer and scan, as we said already, scan the remote network via the printer and get the results. And if you combine all these little services, you might have a lot of fun with printers within remote networks where you don't have even access to. Okay, all the stuff we presented about HP printers, you might get over there. On our page, under HP, you get the source code, the tools we presented in here. That's pretty much it from my side.
Yep,
that's pretty much it from my side. And I'll hand over to FX.
Thanks, man. Okay. Now the sick guy. Yeah, some applause for the guy, please. Okay, now the sick guy with the ponytail, as opposed to the non-sick guy with the ponytail, goes on to some software vulnerabilities, and as you probably expect, it's dealing about routers and stuff. But first of all, software vulnerabilities in embedded systems. Developers are all the same. Embedded system developers are not any brighter. Their devices are just smaller. So they do the same things. Input validation failures, format string, buffer overflow, cross-site scripting. Funny, HP printers, cross-site scripting, no problem. You go to the HP printer, you can enter in favorite URL to add it to the web page. Cross-site scripting vulnerability, totally nice. So I have seen all of those in embedded systems, and you don't need to look hard. It's like you spend more than 5 minutes looking at the security of an embedded system, you probably have already seen 5 vulnerabilities. Embedded system HTTP demons. The worst thing I ever seen, you read a paper from like 1980s about web servers and that long URLs might actually crash web servers and stuff, and you think that's all historic. Go to embedded systems with web servers and try all the old ones. Try them all, and you will find them all vulnerable. I have to see one embedded system web server that actually is not vulnerable to the most basic attacks. The problem here is developers for embedded systems think, well, it's a small device, limited resources, I have to like take shortcuts and stuff, and well, no, this input validation stuff and this buffer checking really takes up too much resources. We don't do that. Well, thank you. Buffer overflow examples. really, this stuff is not like research for several months. This is just looking at the devices. ZDR router, actually an excellent router, unfortunately owned by Lucent. It's actually quite cool for ISP level, like access router level stuff. And they have a web server on it. Now, this router really has capabilities for quality of service and for firewalling, and it's all good implemented. But the web server, you go there, you do a long GET request, the router crashes. Classic instruction pointer overwrite. Thanks. Brother network printer. The same thing. You have an interface card for the brother network printer. You put it in. So your brother can talk to the network and, well, hopefully you can print something. You don't even need to write a script for that. You go to the little web page that it presents, and you say administration, and it says enter password. And you keep your finger on the key, so you have 136 characters, and you click on send, and it dies. HP Procore switch. This is not really a vulnerability in the classic term, because if you have SNMP write permission on a printer or on whatever other device, you're basically home free. But this one is really neat. If you have SNMP write on an HP Procore switch, you go to that MIP variable over there and you fill in 85 characters. Nothing happens. The device is still stable and functioning until the administrator tries to access it. So before you hack around in that network, just set that variable, and as soon as the whole switch goes down, you know someone tries to track you. The next thing is embedded systems can be really small. The SEH IC9 pocket print server is the size of a cigarette pack. I got used to the fact that some people are not smoking, so this is the size of a cigarette pack. This one has the classic mistake already discussed with the brother network printers. You just send a long GET request. You actually send a GET request with the long password on it, and it dies. And well, I mean, this device, we have it in here. It's really small, but it has an Intel 900 processor. It has a network interface, and it has memory. So, well, they should start caring about it, because at one point in time, people are trying to exploit those. Here are the common misconceptions. This is why not half of you guys are embedded system hardcore hackers, because most of you will probably agree to one of those points. Embedded systems, harder to exploit than multipurpose OS. Why? Oh, no debugger built in. I don't have a shell. For some people, it probably is, I don't have a Windows Explorer. Well, and even if you seriously think about it, you have to reverse engineer the whole operating system. It's one big bunch of binary data. You don't know that. And, well, unfortunately, you're not Halva Flake, so you can't really just fire up IDA and find it out. You need to know this is calls, library calls, where in memory is what kept, stuff like that. And after all, the worst thing you can really do with a vulnerability on an embedded system, you can crash it. Well, it crashes or it reboots or whatever, and here's my statement to it. We're going to walk through it just to make sure you don't fear it anymore. Proving it wrong. So we figured, let's pick the next best embedded system we can think of. And yeah, we picked Cisco IOS. That's no news. So the goal is exploiting an overflow. You have an overflow. You stuff many of whatever characters into whatever interface Cisco provides, and it must boom. Okay. So can we exploit that? First thing to think about, the process you crash is not a process. It's that big, fat, chunk iOS. So it probably goes down the pen all the way. Second, Cisco runs on like all kinds of platforms. We're talking about Cisco iOS. Don't fall for the little things that have a Cisco label on it, please. Thank you. And of course, you can't go to sourceforge.net, click on iOS source, download, and have your favorite source code scanner running over it. So it's all closed, and we don't really know. This is kind of interesting. Cisco advisory about TFTP. They still have the standard impact statement, despite the fact that I sent them those slides about 5 times already. Yeah, they still claim that there is no exploitation for Cisco IOS. Let's see. Oops, it crashed. So how do you see that you actually triggered a buffer overflow in Cisco IOS? Well, it doesn't say, Dr. Watson, hey, I'm done. Well, it's called different, but it basically says the same. It's this red zone thing over here, and I just lost my laser pointer. Here it is. This one. Red zone, well, whoever did vulnerability research once knows this one. So you just filled a bunch of A's in the wrong place, and it just died. This is how Cisco mostly will complain about a buffer overflow. So the assumption here actually is, because it talks about blocks and stuff, we might actually deal with heap overflows. And, of course, you always need a vulnerability to discuss this stuff. And we picked a TFTP server, but yeah, for the people of you who went to DEF CON and think they know all the slides, stay here. We have 2 hours this time, so there's more in it. The idea, taking it apart, we just take whatever the device gives us, and we correlate debug output with other useful sources, as Cisco.com, and see what we can get out of it, without reverse engineering the whole bunch or killing one of the core developers to get his laptop and the source code. Albeit this option is quite appealing. So what do we have here? And this is just a bunch of hacks, and taking it apart, this is a magic number. This is a fixed block magic number. Hello, block begins here. The next one is the process ID. Then we have something over here, and if you look at those numbers, and this number, this one is later in memory. So it's probably the next block. Now, directly following is something that's previous memory. So it's probably the previous block. And then this is the size. That was the size of the block. That was not sufficient. And we have over here the most significant bit set to one that means the block is in use. OK, so we saw the memory addresses. Where they are. Are they in like heap memory? Are we writing in code pages? Whatever. So what we do is we ask Cisco. By the way, someone told me the site is no longer existing. So, but if you need the memory layout for the routers, there is a PDF floating around. This is just an example here for the small ones we have in a lab. What we need is, of course, where is data stored? Just to see, okay, this is in data address. The code addresses, interesting, are the platforms where both are the same, of course. And then there's the NVRAM address, very important. Anyone has an idea why NVRAM address could be important to us? That's where the configuration sits. Means that's where the password is. That's where the juice is. That's where we want to go to. So this is basically the target, and we want to modify something. At the end of the day, we want to provide critical information such as passwords. Okay, putting it together, this is how it looks in memory. Those are all 32 bits wide, so it's 4 byte per block here, per custom. we have that block magic, the PID, allocation check space, this is funny, I found out. Those 4 bytes here are actually used so a process can put like a random canary or stuff, or a checksum or whatever in there, and then check if its own block was corrupted. There is not one single process in iOS that uses it. Then we have a code address for the string that shows up when you look at the memory allocation, the PC that allocated it. So basically, those 12 bytes are never used, and you still wonder why you need so much memory to run a Cisco. You have the next pointer to the next block, the previous pointer, the usage size field with a usage flag. Then you have another field reflecting the usage. That's the reference count. How many references do we have? So two different fields to put the same information in. And then you have, at the end of it, what we just overflowed, the red zone. That's basically a fixed canary. It's always this one. So they use that to find out if something went wrong in memory. The theory of the overflow. What we want to do here is basically we have a host block. That one is nice enough to host our evil doing. That's why we call it a host block. And then we have the next block. So the idea is we overflow that one. Overflow the inbound memory management header of the next one. And then, well, make iOS just use the information we just provided. It basically is the same thing as heap overflows on Linux. If you ever read that FRAG article, it's the same idea we are following here. So this is basically what we try to do. Now, after a lot of research, we found out that the best approach is actually exploitation on free. Same FRAG has that once up on a free article. So we try to port that idea over to Cisco iOS. So we have to look what happens on a free. We have a previous previous block, the host block, and the next block. And they are linked. Unfortunately, the projector is not really... Can we have more light on it? Is that like more power? Because there are actually arrows on here. Which are... Well, no, that doesn't work. Little? Well, okay. Thanks for that. So we have those things. They are linked to each other. I laser pointed here. Wow! Don't do that while I look at it. The next pointer points to the beginning of the next block, and the previous pointer points always back to the next entry in the previous block. So, and up on the free, iOS wants to get rid of the host block here. So it exchanges those pointers. So this one is visible, isn't it? So this one points back there, this one points back there. Whoever once tried to program double linked lists, this is what it does. So now the question is, what is checked? What is required? What does iOS really care about? Of course, the magic. I mean, yeah, it has to check where the block starts. Then all this stuff here, PID, RAM address, code address, is not checked. So there is no one in iOS making sure this does not contain bullshit. Interesting enough, the next pointer is also not checked. The previous pointer, in turn, is closely checked. Really, there is exactly one solution in the whole possible key space that will fulfill this check. It's pretty good. We come to it in a minute. Size and usage have to make sense somehow. So if you put too much in there, iOS will complain. And, well, the red zone is, of course, it's checked. Otherwise, it wouldn't see overflows. Now, who's checking that? There are two things. First, we have a process called check heaps. Check heaps is basically kind of a babysitter watchdog process. I assume that early in the development of iOS, they figured that they have lots of heap overflows. I'm not saying that changed. But they discovered, and this is really bad, and like process of writing in someone else's process memory stuff. So we come up with a process called check heaps, which is kicked off once a minute, walks around, grabs that linked list, takes the first block checks, takes the second block checks, and so on. Just to make sure the stuff does not break. Now, the second point where checks are done is when malloc or free is called. Malloc is done or free is done. They check stuff out just to make sure nothing goes wrong. So, well, we saw that the next pointer is not checked, so let's basically take the first target. Cisco 2500. Nice feature allows everyone in the code space to write directly to the NVRAM. And since the next pointer is not checked, we can put in whatever we want. But we just learned there is a pointer exchange going to take place as soon as the free happens. So for a pointer exchange, we provide one pointer, so the other pointer is going to be written to that place. Okay, so we put a pointer to the NVRAM area in that block overflow exactly up to that point. Well, it's a string overflow, so the last two bytes are not transmitted. And, well, yeah, we send that to the router. So what happens here is, okay, let's simulate that. We didn't practice that, okay? Let's simulate that. Here's the router. I'm the bad guy, okay? So I basically sent him an overflow that overflows up to the next pointer. That's this one. Here's the overflow. So what he does is like basically figuring out something is wrong and dying. Now, that's this part. Please die. Thank you.
No games.
The next part is it comes back up. And, well, before dying, the pointer exchange took place. So that other pointer, the previous pointer, got written to wherever we pointed to, which was the NVRAM. Now, the NVRAM contains the config, which is checksummed. Now, the checksum is no longer valid. What happens?
I need a config.
Well, and being the nice guy, I will provide that config. So here goes the config. Congratulations, you just owned the Cisco router. Thank you, router. Disadvantages. Disadvantages here. Well, you have to be on the same subnet, and it has to be a 2500. Might happen, might bring some fun to your life, but really isn't that cool. Advantages, on the other hand, no specific knowledge required. The only thing you have to know is how big is the buffer, add the stuff you need to send to overflow the next pointer, and just wait till the box comes back up and says, need config. So it's pretty easy, basically. Now, to do some more serious stuff, we have to get around this previous pointer check, and this really bites my ass. It is really checked closely, and it is the previous pointer is checked while the block before the one we are overflowing is validated, so we cannot influence that check, unfortunately. The test seems to be, for everyone who can read C, it looks like the next block, its previous pointer, should point back to me, which is a pretty cool way to do it. We didn't find a way so far to fix that, to get around that. So the idea was to basically kick the Cisco device in the ass, so it dies. And when it comes back up, it has a fairly predictable memory layout. You more or less know where stuff is, in contrast to it was running for 2 years. Wait, no, Cisco doesn't run for 2 years. It was running for 2 weeks. So when it comes back up, it has a fairly predictable memory layout, and you can build on that one. So the next one is the size field. As I said, the size field is checked for making sense, to make a broad statement here. The size field, bit 31, the most significant bit, says the block is in use. Now, we're doing an overflow here, which tries to do something on a free, so we might actually consider doing that, making the next block also free, so stuff happens sometimes. Yeah. And also, we have a problem. The usual values don't work. This has far too many zero bytes in it, and we're doing a string overflow here, so no zero bytes. But the smallest number we could actually send over is this one, which is way more than most small routers have. The absolute fun part is this number here works because some brilliant idiot used a 32-bit well, you and did some left shifting, oops, it's correct. No, it wasn't. But, well, It works, so if you overflow and put this number in there, the check is fine. So, more memory pointers. I know it's a bit technical, but well. For free blocks, blocks that are free, we have that huge overhead we already discussed, 40 bytes, by the way. Then we get more stuff. Padding, actually, this is not correct. This should say last delocator, but doesn't really matter. It's wasted memory. There is another magic that says I'm a free block. C coders probably know the dead beef thing. There is another code address that says which PC actually did the free on it. More padding, 8 bytes just for decoration. I don't know why. And there is a free next and free previous. Now, those have both basically the same task as the previous and next pointer in the main memory block, with one significant difference. Actually, two. The first significant difference is they're in a different list. This list is like the list of free blocks. The second big difference is those are not checked. here we go. We have a comparable pointer exchange taking place over here. So you see it's absolutely easy. Write the pointer to the place the other one points to. And we can provide whatever pointer we want. So welcome in my world. You just got an arbitrary memory write. You can write an arbitrary pointer to an arbitrary memory address. Excellent. So the next thing is, where do we put it? I mean, we can write it all over the place, but we wanted to write in some specific place that makes sense and basically gets us the router. There's another interesting part in iOS that's called the process array here. Actually, in some iOSs, it is not there. But that's like 11.0 never seen versions. That array is basically an array of processes. And for every process, it contains a pointer to a process record. Like, for this process, it's indexed by PID. For process 0, go to this place. There is a huge record that contains all information you need for the process. The second field in this record points to the process stack. And now we actually have a place, the process stack, where we could put a pointer. The nice thing is, welcome in the world of embedded systems, everyone can write to everyone else's stack. You can go to whatever stack you want with a pointer exchange and put a new value in there. So the only thing you need is like the place where the return value of some process is stored. And this is quite simple because they don't change for images. So if you have an iOS image running on a router, you can reboot it as often as you want. The return address of less active processes will always be at the same place. So, taking a processor, we have like the stuff I already explained. So this is how that process record looks like. And we have here several ways to take the processor. We can overwrite the safe return address. Basic game. We can overwrite the saved stack pointer in that process record and provide a whole stack. Well, yeah, we could. We could change the current stack pointer for in the process record completely to point somewhere else. We could even change the whole process record entry in a process array because we're allowed to write there also. So, there are tons of ways, but logically, the first one is the best one. Just overwrite the return address. So, next question is, okay, we can take the processor. We can redirect the PC to whatever memory location we want. How do we deliver the code? Well, the problem here is we overflow something, and then we have a pointer exchange up on free. Therefore, a free is taking place. Unfortunately, the free really deletes memory. We're not in Linux world. They really override it with OD bytes. So this is not a place to point to put your code on, because it would be gone. Otherwise, I mean, if you know a processor, it really can make sense of OD as opcodes. You probably can use that. But well, the good thing is the one we're overflowing the header of is considered free because we said it's free. So this one is not deleted or is considered already clean, so we can put our code after the overflow we did. Shellcode. That's the big question, isn't it? What do we do on shellcode? Now, there are several ways. The simple one is this one. I'd probably run over it a bit. You write a shellcode that goes and disables that write protection for the NVRAM. Remember, we still want to write into the NVRAM, don't get sidetracked. You have that write protection. The only thing you have to do is disable that write protection and write some bullshit in there. Then we have the same game as we just demonstrated with the invalid checksum. So what we did is just find out where that is. That's just the processor register saying this memory area is protected. And simple code, invalidate NVRAM. This one is for Motorola. Sorry, I'm an Intel guy. So that code sucks, and the other code I'm showing also sucks. But, well, it's kind of interesting here, the dummy move. We have a move operation here, which doesn't really make sense because we don't use that register anymore. This is exactly the place where the other one from the pointer exchange is written. Remember, it's a pointer exchange. We send one over there, we get one back. This one, unfortunately, lands right in our shellcode. So exactly at offset 14 hex, you have to provide some space to put that other pointer in. So this is over here. This one gets overwritten with the other pointer, gets kicked in D1, and is forgotten of. So this code actually for 1600 or 1000 router actually makes NVRAM writable and writes Coffee Babe, in NVRAM. So that's the one thing. You can do that. Basically, that's a summary. Fake block, the size field, free next points to the code buffer, free previous points to a return address. We took, we selected load meter as a process because it's handy. It's like kicked off all, every 30 seconds and then, well, checks how busy the box is and notes that down. You can take whatever process you want. I recommend using more often, less often used processes. For the next stuff we're going to show, we actually use the check heaps process, which kind of made me happy because it usually is a pain in the ass to get around, and then you use the same process to execute your code. Anyway, you overwrite whatever return address comes along your way and run code to unprotect NVRAM. And this is how it looks like. It dies with an oops because your code didn't really terminate nicely. Boots up, typical Cisco boot up, without the legal blah blah, and then it goes to the network and says, hey, give me config, thank you. That's it. But it's lame. We want to do remote. So iOS seems to use cooperative multitasking, which suits us because we can tell it to shut up and just run our code. It's interrupt-driven, which also suits us because we can disable interrupts. The NVRAM, where we now want to put a new config on instead of invalidating the old one, uses the already discussed checksum. Otherwise, it wouldn't find a checksum error, right? And it has a size field for the size of the config. And a config itself is basically a long C string. It's a text file terminated by a 0 byte and has the end keyword on it. Well, so we can provide that one, I think. The idea for the remote shellcode is we append a new config on the overflow we are doing and tell the code to disable the interrupts so we're not interrupted. unprotect and VRAM, calculate new values, or do that upfront, I don't care. Write the new header and the new config straight down on the NVRAM, and yeah, just to be nice, do a clean reboot on the device, and it comes up with your config. Little issues here, 0-byte limitation, inconvenience, string overflow, we all know the deal. So the standard solution here is Bootstrap code contains no 0-bytes, thus self-modification of the main shell code, like XOR stuff. And yeah, DXORs the config as well, just to make sure it's all, yeah, not 0-bytes. And well, Bootstrap code then kicks off main code, and main code copies config. The problem here is, when we first implemented it, we had a nice little effect. It worked. It copied the config. The router came up and said config invalid. You look at the memory, and every fourth byte of your config is written. Just every fourth byte. Why? And VRAM isn't the fastest on the chip market. So a simple copy loop basically copied it too fast, and VRAM was like, yeah, I'm writing. No, I'm still writing that one. No, I'm still writing that one. Okay, give me the next one. So that doesn't make for a good config. So yeah, you basically unscrew your Cisco, find out what kind of chip it is, find the manual for it. Are you looking for something? Find a manual for it, check it out. Well, it has some obscure idea of what to do and what not to do. Basically, what we did was introduce a delay loop after every copy and make sure it has enough time to write that down. So, and this is the stuff we came up with, finally. It has an overflow with all those A's in here. It has that fake block we're overwriting. Then it has the Bootstrap code, XOR code, and the new config goes on a device, overflows that block, the block gets freed, the code gets kicked off as soon as the stack return address is used, decodes the main code copies the config, reboots the device, and you're done. This is how it looks like. You see no more oopses, because we nice reboot the box. And it doesn't say anything about, well, I'm going to network finding config, but it says over here, set up new interface, BRI0, place and shutdown state. Also priced to find a BRI0 on a 1600. Why? Because our config did not contain any statements about that interface. Sorry. And this is how it looks like from your box on. You just tell it to it, well, the password is the one you just provided, so it's not too hard to guess, and you just reconfigured your Cisco. This is how the code looks like. This is first the block. We basically sum up all we spoke about now. That's the red zone of the former block. We want to provide the canary. Then you have the block magic. Some stuff nobody uses. Next pointer and previous pointer. The next pointer is now more or less not interesting anymore. You just want to point it to some place it doesn't harm. The previous pointer has to be correct, as already discussed. That sucks, I know, but it's still a fact. That funny size field over here, totally stupid reference count. Deallocator. The magic for a free block, yet another pointer, some greetings to CCC, sorry. Fnext and fprevious are the ones pointing to the stack and the code. So this done, it runs the following code. Well, you have it on a CD, you don't really, or on a web pages, you don't really have to read it over here. It's basically the XOR code. As you see, it's all pretty small. It's pure Motorola. We get rid of iOS. We don't have to deal with iOS anymore. We just run the processor ourselves. And this is how you do a clean, nice hard reset on the box. Now, Well, you are sitting here and thinking, well, that's all on a website. What's new? This. Oops, PF. Cisco IOS has another problem with population of neighbors. Remember we discussed the enhanced IGRP stuff? Well, works with OSPF the same way, with the nice side effect that with OSPF you actually override something. So, got a Cisco Bacardi. It's all well known. Overwrites memory structures. Well, we just talked about overwriting memory structures. So, let's go on. The differences here, which made it really interesting for us to research, is it's not single packet. The TFTP one is all one big UDP packet, fire off, die. This one is not. It's an overflow in I/O memory. We come to the big difference in a minute. And it's not at the end of the memory. Like, there are big chunks of memory allocated for TFTP file names and stuff, and it's all easier. Well, this one is not. This one is right in the middle of packet forwarding, memory blocks where little IP packets sit in and wait for delivery. So, details. What happens? We have an overflow. It spits out all the memory blocks that didn't really look nice, and this is what it spits out. Now, for those of you who don't usually do protocol reverse engineering and stuff, this one really smells like IP address badly. AC10 is 172.16 and yeah, whatever over there. So those are obviously the neighbor addresses. We just told it, new neighbor, new neighbor, new neighbor, with different addresses, and they all show up in a block that just overflowed. Could probably, let's see. So it's obviously an overflow with a list of the IP addresses of the neighbors. And, well, is it exploitable? The creation of a list entry here depends on the source address of the IP packet. The IP packet that says OSPF hello. That source address we can provide, of course. But that source address is limited. It has to be in the network statement, whoever does Cisco configs, router OSPF one network 172.16.0.0. It has to be within that range. And the netmask has to be something smaller than the class C one, because the overflow happens for more than 255 neighbors. And this is hard to achieve on a class C network. So it has to be a bit bigger, but that's not a big limitation. The list entry itself is not the IP, the source IP address of that packet. It's the OSPF router ID, and that's sitting in the header. Now, this one is not validated against anything, leave alone access lists and stuff. It is just used as a key for that table, which conveniently we're overflowing. So we can put whatever bytes we wanted to in this IP address and just send it over. Now, we're overflowing I/O memory. iOS uses dynamically scaled list of fixed size buffers. Sounds crazy, doesn't it? No, it's basically it has like those four lists here, small, middle, big, very big, and huge. Obviously, they didn't plan for the later. And those are like, as they say, small, middle, or big, or very big. And it's just a list of equal-sized buffers, and they fire it off and send send whatever packet goes in. They look for buffer that's suitable and put it in there. They also have private interface pools and stuff. Nobody really cares. Let's go. How do we exploit that? The idea is, and I have to translate. I have to say that in German because it doesn't really translate. It's an Überraschungsei exploit. It's basically, you know the feeling someone really bothers you and you buy Überraschungsei, take the inside and go, here, puzzle das zusammen. That's basically what we're doing. Well, every packet can deliver 4 bytes of buffer. The overflow happens bottom to top. Is a copy action doesn't really, is not interesting here. And the 265 IP address provide us with about 1,000 bytes buffer. So, by the way, larger buffers are actually possible. So what we do is send neighbor announcements up to the point where we overflow the buffer, put the right data in what used to be the IP address of the sending router, and overflow that I/O memory buffer. And then, well, we need a memory management trick. Okay, here's the deal. Most of you probably know that sometimes you really have to bullshit management to convince them to do something. This is what we do here with the Ciscos. We have 2 different management groups. Sounds like some companies. The one still thinks all the buffers are the same size. One is free, one is not free, has a buffer allocation list. This is the buffer list view. This is the bad buffer we just played around with. That one still thinks it's allocated, it's good, stuff like that. Now, we overwrite that buffer, and we provide a new header. Now, we say in the header, this buffer is free. And by the way, it's not only free, it's the last one. So it provides all the memory available from here to the end. So it's a real big fragment. And what we basically created is a free used block. For one, it's free. For the other one, it's used. Now, it requires less than the actual TFTP overflow. It just requires the correct previous pointer. Still, yeah, I know. And the correct size up to the end of the memory. And you overflow it. And this is how it looks like. The system stays stable because the buffer pointer list that's used in the operation still thinks the buffer is fine. And you say, like, show mem IO, and you get all those buffers. You see, those are middle. This is a small one. This is a big one. Look who allocated it. It was us. So you basically overflowed, and the system stays absolutely stable for a long time. We really tested that. And the exploit sits behind this block here. Actually, at this address over here, there sits the shell code and waits for execution. You have a dormant exploit on a Cisco. Now, how to activate it? The box has to need more buffers, or actually, the problem is the box has to need more buffers than it actually allocated so far, which is not hard to make, just kick a shitload of traffic on it, or send it a complex routing update, or whatever. And when it discovers it doesn't need the blocks anymore, it will trim them back. It will free memory. Remember, free memory is a bad thing for a Cisco to do when it has some phenolit-provided memory content. This is what we want to do. It frees the memory, and right in this moment, it frees the memory and kicks off a process to do memory like merge memory blocks together. And this process is kind of stupid and works the process blocks down and the memory blocks down and sees, oh, this one is free and it's big. Let's merge them together. It uses the free next and free previous pointers and we're back in the standard game. So we can load the box with traffic or we call the admin and say, you know what, I want to own your Cisco, but you don't have to change the password. Uh-huh. So how do you do it? Just enter buffer small permanent zero and then wait. I wonder how many Cisco admins would actually do that. We had an internal discussion about it and we did not agree if most would do it or not if you call them and tell them to adjust the buffer because there's a new issue with iOS. Anyway, because we don't have too much space in there, this is the absolute minimum config I could come up with. This actually directly written into NVRAM works. It says enable password C, interface Ethernet 0, IP address and default routes, so you can get back to it, password for the telnet interface, and login. That's it. You can make it that small. No problem. Still works. And this is how it looks like. You send it over. You, in this case, I did that buffer is small, permanent zero. You kick that off. It reboots, snip all the info here, finds lots of new interfaces, and, well. So, yeah, I know. You basically all stayed here that long to see the URL. This is it. We're going to release it for the audience here today. It doesn't have too many targets yet. We still have to work on some other iOS versions and targets. Because the memory numbers change, and we don't expect the exploit users to know the numbers and find out. So if you feel like it, go to that 19c3 HTML file. No, there is no link from the main page. And download the preview, PF exploit, for 2500, all kinds of 11.3 that really works. We tried that. Actually, works since yesterday. And there's another tool which is kind of nice because you can make gifts to us. It's called iOS Stack. And you run it against your Cisco boxes. And it will come back with the location of the return addresses you usually need for the exploits. So if you have a Cisco box and too much time and want to do us a favor, run it against a Cisco box, send us an email.
It does nothing else then.
Yeah. It does. Well, at the end of the day, all sounds nice and geeky, but isn't a Tezo SSH exploit. We still have to work on that one. All the guesswork really sucks, and I know, but we're working on it. Those are still more lab than in the wild exploitation techniques. With the NVRAM, it's kind of interesting because... Well, the shellcode can do whatever it wants. Anti-forensic shellcode is kind of funny. You can place... The NVRAM contains the traces you left. You can replace them by some known Cisco bug. So, what's the name of the stupid guy? Thomas Akin's Cisco router forensics attempts really... Well, will lead you probably to the fact that you have a 10.3 iOS issue in your 12.0 core router, whatever. Yeah, and we want a real-time config modification, like you send the exploit to it and it just removes all the access lists so you can better access the firewall, not saying your firewall. iOS exploits are what? Well, most iOS heap overflows are exploitable. Protocol-based, we had two of them now. Debug-based is kind of funny because, like, next to every debug command has an overflow in it. They allocate fixed buffers for that. So if you send something big and the debug command want to show you there is something big, it will basically kill itself. And, well, it's still mostly unprotected, so you can play with it. The NVRAM configs, you can... copy them away with the shellcode, or you do that local exploit where you just invalidate it, still contains the old config. You can decrypt the passwords, find out about the infrastructure, find out about the routing, and play some nasty tricks with it. So, question, well, does anyone care about how to protect here? Yeah, I assume. Well, do not rely on one type of device. If everything in your network that belongs to the security department says Cisco on it, you're screwed. Well, if everything says Checkpoint on it, you're also screwed. So it's kind of mix it together. Do layered security, stuff like that. Consider your networked embedded equipment vulnerable and exploitable. At some point in time, some sick guy... literally sick, will find that interesting, do security testing on it, and write shellcode for it. Do not ignore equipment because it's small. Well, it has a processor, and it can be used for evil doing. for the HPs, if you have HPs, after you played with them and you want to secure them, set an admin password, set SNMP read and write. PGA protection just, well, enhances the fan factor a bit. Allow only the print server to access your printer because nobody else does. And really, if it is critical and your CEO has something top secret, there is a thing called an LPT cable that really secures the stuff. If he's the only guy printing on that box, he might actually be the only guy connected to that box. Really makes security easy. Let's share everything. How to protect Cisco-wise? Well, can't resist saying that, especially for a conference sponsored by Cisco Systems. Don't have overflows in iOS. Don't copy things in buffers that are too small. That's not like the latest message in security. Keep your iOS up to date is just a joke because there is no way to reliably do that. And, well, even if you have your main iOS up to date, as soon as you reboot your router, there's something called a mini iOS. And it has a time frame of like 6 seconds being online and reading the config. Most of those boot or ROM iOSs are 11.0, so they have all the juicy bugs still in there. Don't fear. You reboot the router. I own it. Don't run any unneeded services. Well, that's like the second oldest message. IDS signature, this one doesn't even work for the OSPF overflow. Debug sanity, undocumented command, looks harder at the memory structures and figures something went wrong after we exploited it. There is a hardware you can tell it config register 0, which means next time it boots, it comes up in ROMMON. Unfortunately, you should tell every admin in your company or network, because if someone else says reload, he better gets the car keys. And, of course, perform logging somewhere else and stuff. Protect your syslog host, la la. That's it. Slash talk. Thanks to all those on here, especially Cisco, for being such a nice target. Thanks for sitting here. And that's pretty much it. Questions. Wait a minute. I have to pass that one on here to the Engel. Engel, piep einmal. Keine Engel. Out of Engel error. cool. Okay, here's the question, Mike.
Hi, I'm interested in embedded Java VMs, and I've seen there's lots of other development boards now coming up, shipping with proprietary operating systems and Java VMs all built in, and you can build nice devices with it, and if you program it, you will find it does contain bugs, and it probably contains security flaws, and I wonder if you have researched into other Java VMs.
Actually, you're aiming in the direction of like mobile phones and stuff, right?
No, actually, network devices like the Tiny Board from Dallas,
Semiconductor,
or the JSTIC, things like this.
We're not like the biggest coffee programming fans. I'm a coffee fan and a programming fan, but not combined. So, we're not Java experts, but actually, we have seen that even the shy stuff is supposed to have a virtual machine, and it's more like, overflow everything and don't really look like Java. I expect a lot of bugs in there, especially because the development cycles are so short. So I think it's fairly easy to find issues with that, but we didn't research them so far.
Do you have any resources, maybe other people which are interested in these devices where we can exchange ideas?
Well, yeah, let's talk about that offline then.
Okay.
Other questions? I'm blind.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I think the Q&A phase just timed out, so that's really it. Thanks.